from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in paradise. Well, a walker's paradise. I'm talking about Birmingham, Michigan, a city of about 20,000 people just north of Detroit. Now, go back to the early 1990s, Birmingham was mired in population loss and some economic decline. City planning there in previous decades had led to stores and cinemas closing, a highway that diverted traffic from the downtown area, and the construction of high-rises that stopped new development in the city's core. Birmingham's residents were ready for change. In 1996, the city implemented a plan called New Urbanism. The goal was to calm traffic, build parks, improve streetscapes, and more. And it has essentially worked. Since adopting the plan, Birmingham, Michigan has seen more than 3 million square feet of commercial development, 30 major mixed-use projects, and the city is considered one of the most walkable downtowns in America, according to a report by the Michigan chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. So, what can a city like Rochester learn from Birmingham's success? Birmingham City Commissioner and former mayor is in town to share his insight. It's part of the 2018 Reshaping Rochester series, but first he's our guest here. On Connections, Mark Nikita, City Commissioner for Birmingham, Michigan, and co-founder of Archive Design Studio. Thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here. Glad to talk to you.
Well, and it's always great to get perspective on what's going on around the country, and the folks from the Community Design Center of Rochester try to do that with the Reshaping Rochester series. Maria Fergiuelli is Executive Director of the Community Design Center. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And a board member, Roger Brown, back here, Creative Consultant for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Roger, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
All right. So, Mark, is that pretty good description of what was going on in Birmingham in the 90s?
Well, I think the main driver was that we were starting to see competition from some of our adjacent communities, particularly a giant mall that was going to be expanded in a substantial way, just about a mile and a half to the east of our downtown. And our downtown had, you know, certain shops and restaurants and activity in the commercial area that we felt would be affected by the expansion of this mall. This is in the early 90s. And so we proactively took a look at what we could do to become better. And I think the fundamental idea was, you know, we have a good downtown, we have great bones, we have a historic city, traditional downtown, traditional neighborhoods surrounding it. But the big issue was, how can we become better? You know, how can we take it to the next level and be sort of cooking at all cylinders? I mean, I think that was our general philosophy. So we engaged Andreas Duany and his team from Miami as our leading consultant to direct our master plan. And he created what's called the 2016 plan, which is a 20-year plan of taking the downtown to the next level. And that was essentially what we did.
And this is one of those 20-year plans that actually 20 years later, people are like, wow, that kind of worked, which is one of the reasons Mark is here. It's one of the reasons Mark is in Rochester. Maria, what's going on tonight?
Oh, we have a great presentation tonight. We were really attracted to Mark's work because we understand how much the value of having a walkable community can create vibrancy and really help renovate the city's cores. But it's also a scalable thing, so it can be done at the scale of a small village or even a neighborhood. So that is important. The connectivity and connecting all those special places together is important. But the lecture is tonight at Gleason Works Auditorium at 7 o'clock, and we're very pleased to have M&T as a sponsor that will allow us to present these presentations for free. So please come and enjoy the lecture. And just as a point of information, Home Leasing is our sponsor for the entire series for the second year now. So we're very happy to have them along too.
And because of that, free tonight, 7 p.m., Gleason Works Auditorium. And you're going to hear how this is working in other places, some of the lessons that might apply here. We'll talk about some of those themes this hour. And listeners, if this is one of those things where you hear urbanism, new urbanism, walkability, pedestrian friendly, and you think those are buzzwords, we hear them a lot, what do they actually mean? That's one of the reasons that we're having this conversation, to figure out how it actually applies in practice. So let's set a scene. Birmingham compared to Detroit. Where is Birmingham? How far from Detroit?
Well, we're up the to traditional Main Street, directly up what would be considered to be a streetcar suburb, essentially. It's about 15 miles from the Detroit River, the sort of foot of Woodward Avenue. And we're one of the cities that go out from the center of Detroit. And it's just a series of sort of small downtowns that as you go toward the north. So 15 miles kind of straight up.
And this is an area where people talk about cities, but do you consider yourself a suburb of Detroit?
Well, we are a city officially, and we consider ourselves our own city. But yes, definitely, Detroit is very, very large in the region. You know, it's collectively about 6 million people in the greater Detroit area, and Birmingham is clearly just one of many suburbs that make up the suburban area around Detroit.
Roger Brown, you used the term streetcar suburb. Does that just make your mind race?
We love it.
Okay. So let's talk just a little bit about streetcars, because everything I read on Detroit is pretty conflicting on whether streetcars have worked there. Mark, has it worked there?
You talking about the new streetcar?
Well, take me through
the
history.
Old ones.
Well, the new ones.
The new ones, yeah. We have a new streetcar system. It's called the Q Line, and it's been in place for just around 6 months. It opened in midsummer, so it hasn't been around for too long. It is not a regional. I mean, unlike the streetcar service that I'm referring to,
sure,
that went out into the outer areas, it's really a communicating, what we call a sort of a communicating transit system, which means it connects the downtown sort of districts to each other and some of the big stakeholders in the downtown. The medical center, the university, Wayne State University, Detroit Medical Center, Henry Ford Medical Center, and a whole bunch of other cultural institutions like the Detroit Institute of Arts and the Orchestra Hall and all of these sort of civic places, not to mention many residential and office environments. So it's a 3.5 mile length linear streetcar, goes back and forth. And it's really meant to connect all of these different elements to make it more unified, so that now we have, like would be if you're familiar with, you know, Center City, Philadelphia, or say Manhattan, where there's a place that sort of works on its own in its own right. So you can live, work, and play in an area that's 3.5 miles long and a couple miles wide. It's meant to be a place to make that work more on its own, so you can live, work, and play in one place. So you can effectively live there without a car and use a streetcar to get around to all your needs.
Is it meeting its projections, though?
Initially, it was doing very well. I haven't heard the latest. I think that, as with any of these systems that, you know, we roll out, there was some initial, you know, how many cars do we need? Is it filling the gap? And from, you know, I use it often, and it seems to work well, and I hear more and more about people using it in the way that it's supposed to be used.
You work downtown Detroit, right?
Yes, I work in the downtown core. Right. Some of it is just getting to you know, used to the system and sort of using it in the right way. So I think there's a little bit of a growing, you know, into that situation that we're seeing at this point. But I think it's a big asset, and ultimately it's going to be a very valuable element of making the downtown core much, much stronger. And already we're seeing significant investment in the particular areas around the stations, projects that I'm working on around the stations. And I think that they're going to be quite successful because of their location and proximity.
Okay. Actually, for people who visit, like my wife and I did, went to Detroit last year, actually, and rode the Q Line. And for a tourist or somebody coming in just visiting, it's really a fantastic thing, just because you don't need a car, so you hop in this subway or the streetcar, and you run to various activities along the way, and it's a beautiful thing. And you could equate that to what Main Street Rochester could eventually, you know, have over time, and almost for the same initial length, a little 3 mile, you know, kind of an installation. But, and probably the same with Mark, then over time you could extend either end. You could go out to Bull's Head with an extension. You could go out to Winton Road with an extension. So that whole thing could be really, you know, fantastic.
And you see it as viable?
Well, yes, eventually I do. Now, the city right now and the Rochester Transit Group are studying the possibilities for that. They are, though, focusing a little bit more on bus rapid transit as a more affordable, let's say, in their minds, you know, kind of a system that might be employed. Similarly, like Cleveland, Ohio, for instance, or Columbus, Ohio, and, you know, we're going to have a speaker from Columbus come in and talk about that a little bit. You know, there are obviously discussions on the mode of transportation. You know, the thing for many of us who have been to cities that have streetcars, it is a wonderful form of transportation. In fact, my wife and I are headed to New Orleans in a little bit, and there's streetcars all over the place in New Orleans. And it's just the quality of the ride is a lot different than just the bus. But you can do a bus that has a pedestrian ambiance to it that makes it work and makes it special for a city. So,
Maria, how do you view the viability of streetcars in Rochester?
I think we have to look at it in a broader context of what it would do and exactly be more specific about what exactly it is, what the goals are. And we had a really interesting conversation yesterday, the streetcar versus bus rapid transit. And Mark made a very interesting point regarding that the point of the streetcar and the way it's used as a connector within the urban core is different than bus rapid transit as something that would be a transit system to bring people to and from areas that are remote from the center. So I think people would really enjoy the experience of having a unique way to transfer and connect to places. But I think we have to pick the right tool for the right thing.
So there's a couple of things that we talked with Mark Nikita, city commissioner for Birmingham, Michigan, which is, I think he said 15 miles or so from Detroit, about right?
Yep.
And co-founder of Archive Design Studio. He's in Rochester as part of the Reshaping Rochester 2018 series. Tonight, giving a presentation at 7 p.m., a free presentation. Our City Ourselves, Connecting People and Places is the theme, and that's tonight, 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. He's going to be talking about creating places that we care about. So there's a couple of things. I want to hit downtown Detroit, and then we'll go back to Birmingham, because I was reading an article about what's happening in downtown Detroit. As of August, I think you've got a new hockey arena there, Little Caesars Arena for the Detroit Red Wings.
And the Pistons as well.
They moved from
40 miles from the city center into the core.
Okay, and believe it or not, there is a lot of buzz about a sporting arena, Major League, being walkable. And that is not usually the term you hear for big sort of behemoths that require a lot of parking and a lot of traffic, a lot of attendance. How did that happen?
Well, I think that it's becoming more and more recognized that arenas, stadiums, and this goes back to, you know, Camden Yard in Baltimore when they built that many, many years ago for the Orioles, is that stadiums are big, as you said, sort of behemoth, large-scale facilities that often are activated only so many times a year, and in many cases have been historically introverted in their general design. But it's increasingly become evident to urban designers and planners and architects that these are also opportunities to do more than just simply, fill the space for an internal game, but to actually become a city-building mechanism. And in Detroit, we really are collecting and have collected all of the different success stories of bits and pieces of things that have been done in stadiums and arenas around the world, and are starting to really see how they can become truly city building elements. So in this particular design, I think it's starting to come to sort of full circle, and where as Wrigley Stadium, Wrigleyville, it was directly connected to the stadium, that can happen in current day circumstances as well. So when the designers in the city were pulling together how to deal with the arena for what was the Red Wings originally and became ultimately the Pistons, because they saw what a great arena would be, they wanted to be part of it. So they abandoned their arena 40 miles in the suburbs and moved downtown into the core and joined with the Red Wings, which was a really big deal for the city, and I'm very pleased to see that happen. But ultimately, they sort of took the bulk of this introverted space and tucked it into the middle of a block and surrounded it with buildings that face the street and connect to the street and access the street. So there's retail on the ground floor, office and residential above, and public space around, and no surface parking lots at all. So you go to the arena today, you would walk by it, drive by it, and you wouldn't really think of it as an arena. It looks like a four-story building with offices and restaurants and shops on the ground floor, and you don't really see the arena unless you see the sign that says that there's an arena and another sign that says, Paul McCartney's coming next week, or there's a Red Wing game tonight. You don't know it's an arena. It looks like an urban block and an urban typical urban street. And that's the design of it. And you walk into and through these buildings into an internal concourse, which then you flow into the user space, you know, for the arena, the 20,000 seats, as we have for a typical arena size. All the concerts, the Red Wings and the Pistons, it'll be active about 250 times a year. So now we're bringing, you know, 10, 20,000 people there, you know, 9 out of 12 nights a week, which is quite incredible.
Where is the ocean of surface parking space, though?
In many parking decks all around, and there are surface lots that are already there that are being used, but there are lots that there weren't really new lots created for this. They're essentially existing lots that are development sites in the future that are lots that would use, and they built a few parking decks around it. And frankly, there are dozens of parking decks within blocks of the arena. And they're not active at night because they're mostly for the business community during the day. So it's a great shared parking condition. And where those parking decks are used in the daytime for the office workers, at night, which is where most of the arena activities are, that they'll be filled with people going to the events. I personally don't park near the arena. I park far away because I love walking 4 or 5 blocks, and I want to be away from all that car activity. So when I drive to an event, it's going to be many blocks away, and I can easily walk to it and go in and then walk back and get out, and I don't get in any traffic. So I think it's an exceptional way to go. And the walkability in the whole area is such at such a high level that it's quite pleasant to traverse any number of blocks throughout the whole area.
As a designer, how do you feel about surface parking lots in cities?
Every surface parking lot is detrimental to the quality of that city. So the goal is, in my mind, is there should be no surface parking lots in a good quality urban environment.
None.
None. Yeah, zero. I would say that you park on the street, you park in a lot, or you park elsewhere and take the subway, take the train, take the streetcar, take a bus, walk, ride a bike. Surface parking lots, I think, are directly detrimental. And I think you can proportionately say that the more surface parking lots you have, the less quality urban pedestrian-oriented environment you have. It's correlated. So you add more surface parking lots, you decrease the quality of your walkable environment. And you talked about Birmingham being very, very high quality but walkable environment. Part of the reason why we have created that is that we've increasingly diminished the amount of surface parking lots in our downtown over the years.
Intentionally.
Intentionally. And currently, we really only have a couple left. And thankfully, they're filling in quite quickly. And one of them we're working on right now, which is a city-owned lot, which we have an RFP out to do a development on that, which is just coming in this in the next couple of weeks, which is a request for proposal for developers to develop that surface parking lot. And we've had other surface parking lots that were privately owned that have been turned into developments. So we're losing our surface parking lots gladly.
All right, and this is the song that Roger Brown and his ilk have been singing for years. So before I turn to Roger on that, let me just follow up with one other question.
He's chomping at the bit.
I know. But for those who view parking as sort of a right, I'm going to come from a suburban area, I'm going to come to a city, I'm going to park right in front, I'm going to walk maybe 8 feet, or view surface lots as necessary if you're going to go out and have a good time somewhere. What is the lesson for those who think you can't have a thriving downtown environment without a lot of surface lots?
Well, I think you just go to places that you love. I mean, you know, one of the things that I do and my partners do is we study cities all over the world. And one of the things we look for is what are the places that, you know, this goes to the name of my talk, what are places that we care about? And what does it mean when you have a place that you care about? Well, when you go to those places and you know you don't maybe don't know why you like it and why you feel good about it and why you want to come back and why you don't want to leave. But when you start to analyze what it is that those places are about, you won't see many surface parking lots. You know, you go to certain cities and you won't see surface parking lots. Places that are the greatest places in the world are usually the places that don't have surface parking lots either at all or very, very limited, or if they do have them, they're hidden away, tucked behind things and not in plain sight. That pedestrian edge where the sidewalk is, where the buildings confront, you know, front to street, That's golden. It has to be dealt with in a manner that's just a high-quality environment for pedestrians. The minute you break that down with openings that are parking lots, the minute you diminish the quality of that walkable experience.
Roger?
Well, your focus has to change, period. If you design a city around parking lots and the car, that's precisely what you'll get, is parking lots and cars. But if you design the city around the pedestrian, over time, you're going to get a highly walkable city, and you're going to trade the car maybe for a public transportation or for walking or for bikes or whatever. And if you're and eventually you will start to link up the communities that are surrounding with some sort of a transit system that will take them directly into the city from where, you know, they live in their little villages or towns and things outside.
But Roger, if I may, I understand the point. If you design it not just based on the car XYZ, but we're not designing from scratch. We have already designed for the automobile, so we have to talk about a redesign.
Yes, you do.
Right.
And that's not as easy, and that's not the same thing.
No one says it's easy.
But we had a great conversation this morning about, you know, how do we create a compelling area that is walkable, so compelling that it would make you drive, park, and then walk. So how do we intentionally create those spaces where we allow for that transition? Because as it is right now, we have no way of getting here unless we drive ourselves. There aren't a lot of good alternatives. So part of having alternatives will allow us to have more choices, but currently we don't. But we also know that people will walk any length as long as they're engaged. And we see that when you have like festivals in town, people will park on the lot, they'll take a bus a couple of blocks, they'll walk the length of Park Avenue and back, and then they get on the little shuttle to take them a couple blocks to their car again. But if they're engaged, they don't even notice it. But the fact that there's these interruptions in the urban experience as you walk, and there's a building, and then there's a lot, and then there's a blank wall, and then there's... So the importance is taking the existing environment, filling in those blank spots, very intentionally understanding where you should do that and where you shouldn't, and incrementally changing the environment to really favor the pedestrian.
Okay. Roger, you want to add to that?
Well, it's where you put your focus on urban planning and city building. And, you know, we have for so long just accommodated the car without thinking. And constantly, all of our wonderful older urban spaces that were, you know, done pre-war have just disappeared. And now it's time, and it has been time for so long, to think about more about the pedestrian than the automobile.
All right, so let's go back to 96, and in the mid-90s in Birmingham, Michigan, where Mark Nikita is from. He's a city commissioner there now and co-founder of Archive Design Studio. This was an intentional plan to do that over 20 years. So you weren't going to rip off a Band-Aid immediately. Tell me about some of the changes you made and how that sort of rolled out, because the reason you're here today from Birmingham, which listeners, again, if you're just joining us, it's maybe 15 miles from Detroit, 20,000 people. It is a city, and it is viewed as the harbinger of change when it comes to urbanism and walkability. And it's a success story. But what did you change first, and how did that sort of play with the people who lived there?
Well, our plan was something that we engaged the public and we engaged the civic leaders, and we really explained some of these principles, these ideas, our consultant had a lot to do with sort of communicating the potential of what we could do and where we were going, where we could go. And with buy-in from the community, the idea of making our downtown more walkable, intensifying the kinds of activities that are there. We already had stores and restaurants, and we had a little bit of upstairs office, but really no residential in the core, neighborhoods that are adjacent, residential neighborhoods, but in the core, no real residences for the most part, and, you know, limited retail and some office. But we allowed for those uses to take it to another level, to a higher level of use. So increase the density a bit, raise the height of the buildings to five stories, which is sort of an urban Proper height in terms of the scale of our city. It's very European. It's about a five-story sort of level, around 60, 70 feet high, and build up to the street with no setbacks. So we required that buildings had to be set to zero lot line right to the sidewalks. We required that the sidewalk edge had to be activated with retail. It had to have clear glass. It had to have 70% of the frontage to be glass. So you'd walk by the street and look in into whatever's happening there, a restaurant, a shop. So these are sort of the subtle things. But it also included enhancements of our streets, narrowing some streets, adding street parking, activating some of our sidewalk conditions, and our main public square in the middle, which is our sort of a park called Shane Park. Changing that park, which was half parking lot, surface parking lot, and half park. The plan was to take the entire thing and make it into one big park and diminish the surface parking lot, actually park those people on the street. These were also as public space, public realm, sidewalks, crosswalks, buildings, materials, heights, massing, scale, all of those things were part of the plan. So it was a lot of sort of elements, and we just, once we got it done, in terms of a plan, the community believed in it, and the leadership believed in it, the city commission at the time, which I wasn't on, but the planning board, which I was on. We all believed in it, we understood it, and we knew the value of it, and we kept beating away at on the implementation over the course of 20 years.
All right, so Greg and Fairport, I'm coming to you in a second on the phone, but I want to follow up with Mark on one point. You said we all believed in it. I don't believe you. I believe most of you believed in it.
Well,
but there's a culture change, isn't it? I mean, I understand the point you're making. Yeah. It took some time. Yeah. There's some buy-in.
Clearly.
What was the hardest thing for people to get used to, if there was one?
You know, I don't know if there's any one thing that I would say that was exceptionally difficult.
Because you maybe get snow. You get hard weather like we do. This is easier.
We have the same weather, yeah.
Yeah.
Weather is not an issue.
Okay.
I would say that one of the things that was a bit of a challenge initially was accepting the increased height of the buildings. That was a challenge for some. And yes, I'm sorry, I don't mean everybody, surely. I'm making a just general statement on that. But clearly we had a lot of buy-in. We had a lot of support from many, you know. But yeah, there was some growing pains initially. There's no question. And some of those things were the plan says that the buildings can go higher and be a little bit taller. When we started implementing it, meaning the first building that was built, that was a bit of a challenge for people. There was some people that found that to be too high, too much, too big, too urban, you know, and then there was some pushback. And so there was some growing pains, as there would be with any plan. And but the plan was solid enough and thoughtful enough and had enough background to sort of support the initiatives that we were putting in place, that even though those challenges were there, we sort of worked our way through it. And once those things were sort of put in place, people sort of started seeing how it's not that bad, and then it's been accepted. And that's where we've been for many years.
And you communicated very well with the public.
We tried as much as we can. I mean, it's always a challenge, but, you know, engaging the public is very important. Absolutely.
All right, let me grab the phone call from Greg in Fairport. He's got a question for the panel. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi. I was just wondering. So I know that in Birmingham, their median income there for a family is like $110,000, which, I mean, that's a similar tax base to maybe something like Pittsford. But I'm wondering how you can take those same principles and apply them to a city like Rochester, which the tax base and the dollars available, just they're not the same. So like when you talk about instituting different type of parking, I mean, underground parking could be like 50 times more expensive per spot than, you know, street parking. So I'm wondering how you'd be able to push those principles in Rochester.
Greg, thank you for the phone call. And Mark, if you missed the first part of the call, he's just saying that, you know, just looking up some medium income numbers from Birmingham, it compares more to Rochester suburbs than the city itself. And that may give a city like Birmingham advantages to get things done, whereas a city dealing with more poverty might have more challenges. And is it apples to apples? Can these lessons apply here?
Well, we're not advocating necessarily for underground parking, although that's always great if you can do it. But we don't have much underground parking in Birmingham, so I understand that's you know, that is definitely more expensive. What we've done is created a strategy for where to put the parking. And going back many, many years, and this goes way beyond, much beyond the the 2016 plan or 1996 when the plan was put in place, we had recognized early on that we should build parking decks as a means to put our parking as an opportunity for people to park and eventually diminish the surface parking lot. So many years ago, decades ago, frankly, we invested in 5 parking decks that surround the downtown core. And we created an authority, a parking authority, which allowed the parking to be the businesses in the core to be assessed a parking fee or tax, which would ultimately pay for the parking. And then they wouldn't have to actually create parking on site for themselves. So they would actually use the system. And the system is funded through this this authority. And that's been a system for many, many years. It's worked very, very well for us. And now we have 5 decks that are very well positioned as in a sort of a surrounding circumstance around the downtown. And then all of those businesses can use those decks. So your workers, your visitors, your customers, whatever, can park in the street or park in those decks. And as we've lessened the amount of surface parking lots, that's just allowed those decks to fill up. And that's been a very, very good system. As a matter of fact, frankly, that's been a number of the planners and people that have studied our city have recognized that as one of the key components that we did early on. Mm-hmm. And this goes back into the, like, 60s. That really was a foundational element that helped us take our plan to where it is today.
Okay. Marie and Roger, you want to weigh in on that? I thought it was a fair question from Greg, you know, comparing maybe tax bases and opportunity to change.
There's a couple of things. There's, you know, the idea of creating parking decks is maybe something that's temporarily necessary to accommodate the car situation that occurs right now. And you can design those decks to be convertible in the future into actually regular either apartments or offices or whatever by just designing it in a particular fashion. Also, you can set up a parking deck situation that is surrounded by retail, by residential, almost similar to the way the stadium was done by surrounding it. And so that you're there, it's there and available, but it doesn't intrude, you know, onto the landscape. You still have created a tremendous area for walkability and for
you have to be very intentional about how you do that. And the idea that we have to have the understanding of the value of creating that walkable community, and then that helps us kind of evaluate where we're going to create those communities. You can't have every street be the ideal pedestrian experience, but there are streets that are great for allowing traffic to go through the area, and there's streets that you can dedicate to create that pedestrian experience that you want to.
So. Here's Ian emailing the program saying, Evan, I recently visited Detroit around New Year's for a basketball game, and I thought the design of the new stadium was great. As someone who works at an architecture firm and as a big fan of new urbanism, I was very impressed not just by the building but the direction of the surrounding area. I was able to find street parking nearby, and, though it was cold, I found the walk enjoyable and engaging. And I hope to see similar development in Rochester moving forward. I look forward to seeing Mark Nikita's talk tonight. That is from Ian. Ian, thanks for the email. Tonight, 7 p.m. at the Gleason Auditorium. The Gleason, what's the name? What's the full name of it? Gleason Works?
I'm not exactly sure, but it's in the Gleason Works on East Avenue. And in the plant, they actually have this great auditorium.
If you haven't been there, it is a great auditorium, and it's 7 p.m. tonight, and it's free. It's part of the Reshaping Rochester series from the Community Design Center of Rochester, and Mark Nikita is here, the City Commissioner for Birmingham, Michigan, and co-founder of Archive Design Studio, Maria Fragiuli, who is Executive Director of the Community Design Center, and Roger Brown, who is a creative consultant for them. Let's get our only break of the hour. I want to come back to more of your comments that have come in via email, and if you want to call the program as we talk about new urbanism and we talk about creating places we care about, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the flu has been particularly nasty this year, more deadly than usual. We're going to talk about why and what doctors locally are seeing in their own clinics. In our second hour on heart disease, some new treatment options. We're going to talk to a transplant patient. We'll tell you about new technologies in the works and in the field. What's happening when it comes to heart disease? That's all Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Thank you, producer Megan Mack. It's the Gleason Works Auditorium. The auditorium in Gleason Works is at 1000 University Avenue. If you haven't been there, 7 p.m. tonight. Tim emails the program to say, Evan, as a designer, I'd argue that redesigning to a walkable plan is actually easier. We already have the experience of driver-focused cities, and we know what works and what does not. I don't know, Tim. I've been to old Europe where it's much more walkable and the car is viewed with a little bit of scorn. And so I take the point that we know what works and what does not. And there's a big opportunity here. There's a big opportunity to make some changes. And that's why we're talking to Mark Nikita from Birmingham, Michigan. Birmingham is a city near Detroit. And, you know, it's known as a city, but, you know, around here we would think of it as a suburb. How important is it to connect suburbs or nearby cities to larger cities, Rochester to Webster, Rochester to Pittsburgh, Rochester to Gay, whatever the question or the place is, does that connectivity matter, Mark?
Oh, I think it's very important that a region works as one. I'm going to touch on this tonight in my talk, this idea that that you're a city and you're not part of the region is something that really doesn't work, and it's not in the best interest of anybody. So that, you know, we don't live in city cores anymore. I mean, the city of Rochester, city of Detroit is not independent. It may have been many, many years ago when there weren't really suburbs, or suburbs were very, very limited. But now, as we've grown and much of our cities have grown, the suburbs have become part of the city. And in many ways, we are one. And this has increasingly become notable. Brookings has done a number of Bruce Katz and Brookings Institute have done a number of studies about the importance of metro areas being unified and how they're economic drivers. And frankly, if you look at the reality of America, we have about 350 or so metro areas that are really driving the economy. It's those 350 places that are just, you know, regional Rochester, regional Detroit, that are really driving. It's where most people live, and it's where most of the economy is made and created, and where our economic drivers are. So we need to start thinking about metros as a place and as a unit, and less about cities and suburbs. And the more we do that, and the more we look at it as a unified situation, because cities have great value, suburbs have great value, people live in one place, work in another, play in another, and as we look at them working more unified, in a unified manner, and can work in a collective manner, it's going to strengthen their position. For a long, long, long time, as you know, speaking of Birmingham and Detroit, Detroit City, the core, has had significant struggles and difficulties. We're on a serious comeback at this point. A lot of challenges remain, as with many American cities. But the bottom line is our city has been detrimental in the mindset of many. And so many suburbs have sort of shunned historically from the city. And that's not been good for really for anybody. It doesn't help the city, and it really doesn't help the suburbs, because how successful is a suburb on its own? Really, if you don't have a core city and the whole thing isn't cooking at all cylinders, it doesn't really work well. So the logic in that is, how can you do what you do best and everyone else does what they do best, and how you can work as a unit? Because not everything is all the same. Not everybody does everything. So somebody does something really good, something that does else really well, and put it all together, and you have a great, great mechanism to promote, activate, to live, work, play, and to be, and hopefully to bring in business and people to come in and want to be part of it in some capacity.
I'm going to get back to the phones in a second, but I want to follow up with Mark and then get our other guests to kind of contextualize this to Rochester. Birmingham and Detroit are connected. How would you describe that connection?
Physically?
Yeah, in physical space.
Yeah, we're 15 miles as the crow flies, but also as Woodward Avenue, because it's straight out one street. So we are connected directly in one street. We're connected by car. We're connected by bus. And, you know, we have a bus system in Detroit and nothing too much more other than the Q line downtown. But we have certain freeway access that are relatively close by. But essentially, Woodward Avenue is the connecting device. It's the, you know, it's one of the streets. It's like your Monroe Street or something that goes right, you know, a long distance, picks up a number of cities, and they all sort of work together, you know, on one line.
Okay. And that's how we're connected. Roger and Maria, do you view this as relevant here in Rochester?
Yeah, you know, Rochester is actually designed beautifully for connecting to the periphery of the city with its radial streets. And it is really, what sorts of transportation do you put on those radial streets that go out to Pittsburgh, to Webster, to Greece to wherever. And, if you want to make a downtown vital and active and alive and so forth, it's going to require more than just the residents that live in the city itself. It is going to require people coming in easily from the periphery. And so some sort of, now in the case of Detroit, the Q line does it for a certain section. In Cincinnati, it does it for a certain section. And it's really sort of the beginning over time of some of the transportation entities that can be created over time for these cities. Rochester right now is doing the study. The RTS is doing a transportation study, and hopefully it will talk about, that aspect of enhancing its bus system to the point where people don't have to drive in. They can take, a bus or whatever and come in to the downtown. So,
Maria?
Well, as you said, Roger, the way our city is designed with all these radial streets that connect us out, it's a great foundation for a terrific plan that would do something like having a streetcar act as a connector in the downtown core, and then having a chance to have this transitional space between the city and the suburban area where when people have some other transit option, some kind of line that goes from down Monroe Avenue all the way down to Pittsford and down Hudson all the way up north and up Lake all the way up to Charlotte, all of a sudden you create these linkages, these different systems that do specifically what they do very well and allow people to transition from their car to another mode of transportation somewhere not within your core. I mean, that's what we want to create. And with Mark saying that the parking garages were, strategically placed around the periphery of their core, that's very important because we need to create that option for people to be able to transition from one mode of transportation to the other.
All right, let's get back to the phones. And this is a member of Rochester City Council, Molly Clifford, on the line. Go ahead, Molly.
Hello, Evan and Maria and company. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up another aspect of walkability and something that's taking place this Saturday in the Edgerton neighborhood in Northwest Rochester. Thanks to Common Ground Health and the Edgerton Neighborhood Association, we're doing a walkability assessment of the neighborhood, really focused on getting people out of their houses and walking for exercise, safe places for kids to be able to walk around and walk to school. And we're very excited about that, so wanted to let people know about it.
And so what do they need to do to participate, or what do you expect to come out of this, Molly?
So what we hope is we get the neighbors together and other people who have an interest in the Edgerton neighborhood, and it's at the Edgerton Recreation Center, 41 Backus Street, at 11 on Saturday. And people are basically going to walk around the neighborhood and look for routes that are more conducive to walking. We do have some drug houses, we've got some vacant houses. There are some places that you might want to avoid, but Edgerton also has Jones Park and the Edgerton Park and really nice places to walk around. So how do we get people out and about in a safe and really active way?
Thank you, Molly. So that's 11 a.m. Where?
At the Edgerton Recreation Center, 41 Backus Street. It's about a block west of Lake Avenue.
All right, that's on Saturday. See you there. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Molly Clifford, member of Rochester City Council. She, of course, was also involved in the recent charrette up in Charlotte, as were our other guests here. Roger, you want to
jump in? Well, the charrette, is a wonderful example of where you take the participants and you go outside of the areas that they live in and walk it. And it's fascinating the comments we always get about things like, I didn't know this was here, or I didn't know it was such a pleasant walk, or I didn't know this or that. They really get to know, their area, and encourages them really to, instead of driving around, which they don't really pay any attention other than the street and where they're going to go, of the ambiance and of the character of the areas that they live in.
And so I think an overwhelming comment that we received was they didn't realize how close everything was. Everything seems to be somewhat disconnected. There's the commercial strip, and then there's the area by the river, and then there's the park. But we walked end to end in the whole study area, and it was a short, pleasant walk, and it was easy to get from one side to the other. And I think that was a revelation for a lot of people.
All right, let's take a phone call from Southview, Michigan. This is Jeff calling. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I've lived in Rochester for a huge portion of my life, and now I've moved to Southfield, Michigan. I'm an electrical engineer. And the idea of Birmingham and Rochester are two completely different animals. One is an area where people live and play, and they work in, say, a city like Detroit, whereas Rochester is a much more blue-collar city. And I understand the idea of urban design principles, but how can a city like Rochester be compared to Birmingham when they're working with two completely different tax bases, they have two completely different environmental industrial issues, and they're two completely different animals?
Jeff, I appreciate the sentiment of the question, and I'm going to start with Maria and Roger on that because they wanted to bring Mark in, and then we'll get Mark's thoughts as well. Go ahead, guys.
I would say that the principles that create good urbanism are something that relates to every place. And although, yes, maybe Birmingham is different physically, but yet there are characteristics of it that when you focus those on the idea of walkability, they are the same and they equate to
both. Yeah, the fact is that when it comes to walkability, it's easier for someone to park and want to walk to a long distance when they have a very attractive walk, when there's somewhere that's very, very desirable that they're walking to. And if you have something like a parking deck, it costs, 20 times more to build a parking deck than it is to build surface parking? I understand these principles and they're great, but Rochester is a much different city that can't afford these types of principles.
I'd have to say you can't afford not to do these things. When you look at...
No, I understand, and I think there's no long-term planning. I really do understand what you're trying to say. But to compare a suburban bedroom community to an industrial hub of upstate New York is two different animals.
All right, Jeff, first of all, thank you for taking time.
If you want to compare, say, Pittsburgh, New York to Birmingham, we completely understand what you're saying.
Yeah, sure. And that's why we've made some of the comparison. And Jeff, thank you for the phone call. And thanks for listening, by the way, from afar. It's great to have Rochester expats listening to Connections, likely via mobile app. And everyone should have the WXXI mobile app. But we've done a couple of things here, Jeff. I would just say, number one, we've asked Mark, who works in downtown Detroit, to talk about Detroit itself. Now, it's a bigger city than Rochester, but there's some comparability with economic revitalization challenge, job loss, what it takes to get a city back on its feet. I'm from Cleveland, and Cleveland had a promotional video years ago that said, at least we're not Detroit. And Detroit took that personally, and now they're doing pretty well. So I know there's some, Mark's looking at me like, I can't believe you just brought that up. But the point is, there are some parallels with Rochester and Detroit, and there are some things I think we could probably learn from what's going on in Birmingham, even if it's not apples to apples. But Jeff, I think that's also a fair question. So Maria, why don't you, Roger's making a point that we can learn from anybody who's doing new urbanism well. What would you say to Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that we bring people like Mark here is for us to be able to share with the community a view down the road. It's so hard for people to envision what something can be. So here, Birmingham went through this amazing transition. 20, 30 years ago, they probably weren't. I probably can guarantee to say that it wasn't the walkable and engaging community that is now. They very intentionally set some goals. They implemented a plan, and we're seeing the benefit of that. And we're in a position in Rochester where we can learn a lot from those experiences of other cities and understanding we have all the tools that we need and the way that we should appropriately implement them to suit our particular needs as a community. There's certainly a lot of opportunities for development and some growth.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, I concur with, I think, essentially what Roger said specifically in the beginning of his comment, which is these principles are applicable everywhere. And it is absolutely wrong to connect them to the value, the economics of a particular place, or even the physical conditions of the place, meaning if it's a suburban sprawl city suburb versus a very urban traditional suburb that's hundreds of years old, these principles apply both ways. So these are pedestrian-oriented principles. They're logical urban development principles. They apply everywhere, and they apply in all the great cities that you go to that you feel are places that you want to be in. That's what makes those kinds of places. And so they apply really everywhere. So it's not about economics, and it's not about what you have to work with. Every city can be better for the pedestrian than it is currently. Every city can be better. And these are principles that will apply everywhere.
All right, let me grab one more quick phone call. Matt in Rochester, waiting to jump in. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Evan. And So I'm the president of my neighborhood association, and I know the city right now, talking about long-term planning, they are actually developing their plan for 2034 for the Bicentennial of Rochester. So taking the plan to mind that 96 plan, what was the value of community input into the development of that long-term plan? Because I know Rochester is trying to reach out to various neighborhood associations to develop their plan.
A great question, Matt. Thanks very much. I appreciate that. I know your neighborhood appreciates the work you're doing in Rochester. He's asking, you go back to the mid-90s, you came up with this 20-year plan that you launched in 1996. How much community input? How did that work?
We had quite a lot of community input. And I think, you know, we touched on this morning, the clarity of the ideas that were put forth to become the plan. The communication between sort of the, you know, the drivers of the plan or the creators of the plan, in this case, Andres Duany and his team, and the civic leaders at the time, which are the city commissioners, as well as some of the staff members, and then all the residents that participated. And we had thousands of residents that participated in this process. The buy-in to that was exceptional, and meaning that the understanding of where we were going and what we were trying to do and what the plan would ultimately become was a very, very important part of that. And that communication allowed us to have a really strong buy-in. And that buy-in allowed us to move the plan forward, regardless of who was, you know, at the time driving the ship, because the what we call the holder of the baton kept changing, but it was so clear that it kept moving forward and positively being implemented.
Mark Nikita is the city commissioner for Birmingham, Michigan, co-founder of Archive Design Studio, works in Detroit, and he is in Rochester as a guest of the Reshaping Rochester series, Creating Places We Care About. Tonight, 7 p.m., his presentation is free and open to the public. It's at Gleason Works in the auditorium. That's at 1000 University Avenue. We appreciate you being here, Mark. Thanks for popping into the studio for the conversation today.
Glad to do it. It was fun.
Roger Brown and Maria Frigiuelli from the Community Design Center of Rochester. Have fun tonight, and I know we've got more to talk about in your series ongoing. Check out cdcrochester.com. Org?
Org.
Org. Thank you, Maria. cdcrochester.org for the full schedule if you don't see them tonight. Thank you for being here, Maria. Roger,
thanks,
always
so
good.
Much.
Tim George, Rob Braden, Megan Mack, the wonderful team behind Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you Thursday.